Good day, Crime Talk aficionados. My name is Scott Reich, and this is Crime Talk. We have a huge docket, but mostly about one case. That's right, the Barry Morphew case. The defense attorneys are fired up, and they want this case dismissed. Wait until you hear the reasons why. Next, we have an update on the Lauren Panzenza case, and then we have a conversation about two Utes of America, and then some dumb criminals, of course. Let's talk about it. Good day, Crime Talk aficionados. My name is Scott Reich. This is Crime Talk. Thanks for joining us. Today is Friday, March 25th, 2022. You know the drill. If you haven't done so already, hit the subscribe button, hit that like button, leave me a comment. Make sure you hit that little bell so you receive notifications. And remember, if you can't watch us here on YouTube, you can always listen to us anytime, not only this episode, but any of them, by simply typing in Crime Talk on your favorite podcasting app. All right, let's open the record for Friday, March 25th, 2022. Well, the defense attorneys for Barry Morphew, for those of you who are not familiar with the case, Barry Morphew is accused of the death of his wife, Suzanne Morphew, who went missing on Mother's Day in 2020. Now, no body has been found, but she's basically been declared deceased. And literally a year after her disappearance, and as Mr. Morphew was literally heading out of town, the prosecutors decided to file an affidavit for an arrest warrant and were able to receive an arrest warrant for Barry Morphew in regards to the death of Suzanne Morphew. He has vigorously defended himself. He has hired some very good attorneys, and they have gone after the district attorney or their lack of diligence, it would seem, based upon the motions that have been filed. Now, the prosecution has got themselves in a little bit of trouble because the prosecutor was running around doing interviews, including some of the people that we're friends with, Profiling Evil, where she said basically she's going to get Barry Morphew and that he's a bad guy and that he is guilty. Well, ethically, attorneys can't go around talking about cases like that, particularly ones that they are on. So that created some issues. The court put a gag order in effect, but it hasn't been the most well-run case in regards to the prosecutions of a homicide case that I've ever seen. Let's just put it that way. And that happens a lot of times when small town jurisdictions get a huge case and they bring in people with resources for the defense, and they hold their feet to the fire. So that's kind of where things stand. And throughout the case, the defense has been making requests saying not everything has been turned over. Well, there's been two motions that have been filed, and we're going to go through these in pretty good detail today. First, it's the supplement to motion for discovery sanctions, February 28, 2022 through March 8, 2022. And it's regarding discovery production. For those of you who don't know, discovery is all the police reports, emails, text messages, you name it, anything related to the case that the police officers have done, and particularly everything that's inculpatory that would show that somebody has guilt. But the prosecution also has an obligation under law to turn over exculpatory information. Okay, that is anything that would reduce either one's exposure to being guilty or anything that would go to anything that could possibly reduce sentencing. So really what it boils down to is the prosecution has to turn over just about everything. The motion that was also filed was a motion to dismiss based upon presentation of false testimony at the pretrial hearing. Now this one, it swings for the park, and it is going directly after the district attorney. So let's take a look at it and see what they have to say. Now, it's very clear in this motion, and they state that as of the filing of this motion, multiple additional items of information favorable to the defense have not been produced to the defense or have been withheld for months and then produced after multiple discovery sanctions hearings. Certainly, discovery is not being produced as soon as practicable pursuant to Rule 16. The late and or not produced favorable discovery are enumerated as follows. And let's just go through them. First, in a February 28th email to the prosecution, the defense requested Range Rover PowerPoint, and they cite the exhibit, see email attached. The prosecution did not respond, and on March 2nd, 2022, the defense filed Defense Motion 17, which is the supplement to the motion for sanctions. Mr. Hurlburt advised the court that the defense never conferred with them prior to filing Defense Motion 17. This statement was false, as evidenced by the February 28th email attached as Exhibit A here too. See, that's why you put everything in writing, ladies and gentlemen. Because it's a confirming email, you look like the good guy, and then when it doesn't get turned over, you say, Judge, look, we've tried to do everything we can. We're trying to resolve this without court intervention. And that's exactly what they did. After the March 4th hearing, on March 6th, the defense once again emailed Deputy District Attorney Hurlburt with the February 28, 22 conferral email, and once again requested this data. To date, there's been no response. See, Exhibit B, the March 6, 2022 email from Ms. Itan to Mr. Hurlburt. On February 24, 2022, Deputy District Attorney Rob Weiner represented to this court that a dart cannot be fired from a regular firearm. This was flatly contradictory to a statement the prosecution attested to in documents filed in this court. And they specifically say, see Defense 58, People's Response Motion to Sever Counts. These darts can be shot from the dangerous weapon, see affidavit. The possession of the short rifle is one method that the defendant may have been used in this murder. In open court on February 24th, Mr. Weiner confirmed that the statement in the prosecution motion, D58, and their response was not accurate. The evidence that a dart cannot be shot from the gun is highly favorable to the defense. That's what they refer to as exculpatory evidence, and if the prosecution knew about it, they had to turn it over. On February 25th, the defense requested the documentation of this statement and favorable evidence. See Exhibit C in the motion. Prosecution did not respond. The defense followed up requesting the information again on March 6th. See Exhibit B. On March 3rd, the day before the motion hearing regarding sanctions on the D-17 motion, the prosecution provided additional discovery identified as Discovery Packet 24. As a result of the prosecution arriving the day before the March 4th hearing, the defense was unable to do anything but skim through the discovery prior to the next day sanctions hearing. After the March 4th hearing, the defense was able to read the material provided and learn that in violation of Rule 16, that's the rule that says the prosecution has to turn over discovery, and the court's order, it included material such as emails that were created as long ago as May of 2020 and which were given to the prosecution sometime between November 2021 and January 18th of 2022. But these texts and emails were not produced until March 3rd of 2022. This is literally between 4 to 22 months after they were created, the emails, that is. And it goes on, paragraph 6 says that the discovery received on March 3rd includes a CBI email indicating that they have self-determined that they will produce electronic correspondence on a two-month cycle. The email string, there's an email which indicates CBI's email would be consolidated and sent to the deputy district attorney in this case to determine what is material for the prosecution in this case. Notably, the email does not establish the actual constitutional standard that material favorable to the defense must be disclosed. She's right on that one. So the defense is saying that because the Colorado Bureau of Investigation and the district attorney have basically self-created and self-instituted a policy about how emails were to be disclosed, the CBI produced emails and texts to the prosecution that were created in May of 2020 and collected between November of 21 and January of 18 of 2022, and they weren't disclosed until March of 2022. By design and implementation, the prosecution's plan appears to be that the defense will receive CBI notes, emails, and texts at least 4 months after they were created. Now, let's just jump to a couple of examples of things that should have been turned over. And this is a big one. And this is a representative sample, favorable information that was produced on March 3rd, months after it was supposed to be disclosed. This is huge. One, May to July of 2022, there's a text string between multiple CBI agents involved early on in the investigation. And it states on June 29, 2020, Agent Kevin Kobach, K-O-B-A-C-K, writes to 9 to 10 law enforcement agents, "I have had multiple conversations with Andrew Moorman over the last few days. Andy, as you know, has changed his direction in the investigation and fully believes Cody Cox is involved in the disappearance murder of Suzanne." And they attach the exhibit. The court may recall that Andrew Moorman, Suzanne Morphew's brother, has written numerous victim impact statements to this court about his fear that Morphew murdered his wife. May 18th, the text from Agent Kobach to 9 to 10 law enforcement agents says, "Can we give access to the SO to Google Drive or SmartForce or a synopsis for overviews?" So as early as May of 2020, the SmartForce database was created. At present, the SmartForce database has still not been produced to the defense. And as the court may recall, it was Mr. Cahill, former CBI special agent, who disclosed to the defense the existence of the SmartForce database in the surreptitiously recorded interview on November 3rd of 2021. It would be noted that the SmartForce database, all law enforcement witnesses and the district attorney's office have access to this database, and it originated back in May of 2020, but the contents have not been turned over or produced just yet. There's another text from Joe Cahill and to many other agents. "Unfortunately, there's no cell service at the house. As the court knows, the reliability of the cell service is a highly debated issue in this case as a result of the collection of the GPS and cell phone data. Here, Mr. Cahill confessed this fact on day 2 of the Morphew investigation." That would be exculpatory, ladies and gentlemen. May 11th, 2022, a text from an unknown Dave. "Miss Morphew was identified as missing, that the sheriff already suspected foul play and the husband's involvement." This is exculpatory in the sense that it shows that law enforcement had blinders on from the very beginning of the case and hung their hat on the cliche that if the wife is gone, it must be the husband who did it. Another big one here. November of 2021, there's an unresolved match from 27.1, the DNA on the glove box, to DNA in Maryland. The Maryland DNA was produced to CBI, but not produced to the defense. And the conclusion reached by CBI and the Maryland CODIS representative was that the match would remain unresolved. Now, in a footnote, the defense notes that the defense did not have a chance to thoroughly review the new discovery. And on March 4th, in court, the defense stated this unresolved match was from Michigan, but it was from Maryland. Also produced were handwritten notes with the date of November 18th of 2021 and the name Chris Schaefer at the top of the notes. The handwriting appears to be different from the handwriting in Exhibit M. The ambiguity of Schaefer's name can mean only one of two things: either these are his notes or the notes of an attendee. What's the significance? Well, the notes represent that more than 10 CBI agents were involved in a discussion about CODIS, emails, and impartiality standards. Additionally, there were discussions about CBI communication log entries, which have been the primary source of relevant and material discovery to the defense and law enforcement. The list continues on. Now, this list continues on, and the defense notes that the information individually and cumulatively with the information provided in this supplemental motion demonstrates a widespread effort to withhold and intentionally not record investigation efforts and briefings that would be helpful to the defense. The court has already told the prosecutor that they have to turn certain things over or they're not going to be able to use it. And as I noted at the beginning, this kind of shows you what happens when a small town jurisdiction suddenly gets hit with a big time case. They get overwhelmed. Half the battle in a large case is document management. And sometimes these district attorneys are simply not equipped when they have a small office of 3 or 4 attorneys at most, and maybe a couple of support staff, where this would be a full-time job when they still have to run the rest of their office. And frankly, it makes them look like they cannot handle the job at hand. Clearly, the defense is all over the prosecution. Remember, this trial starts in May, and according to the defense motion, no expert reports have yet been turned over, and this motion is dated March 3rd. Now, there's going to be another hearing on all of this information, but there's yet even another motion, which basically the prosecution says the district attorneys are not being truthful at all. And in their motion, the defense highlights, in their perspective, evidence that the court has heard and undoubtedly identified for itself falsehoods in the evidence presented at hearings before this court. A partial list of the topics of false testimony include the reason for Barry Morphew's arrest on May 5th, falsifying CBI support for Morphew's arrest, reasons for removing the primary investigator, CBI agent Joseph Cahill, from the Morphew case and the major crimes unit, presenting unsupported, false, undisclosed testimony regarding the CODIS matches at the preliminary hearing to convince the judge to find probable cause and keep Mr. Morphew from being released on bond or an extraordinary high bond, as well as filing pleadings with false information. The defense then goes on to let the district attorney know of their obligation, and basically that is to let them know it's not just to put people in jail, but their job is to do justice and that they must play fair. They cite a quote from Berger versus United States, 1935 case, okay? This is, and it states, the prosecutor is the representative, not of an ordinary party to a controversy, but of a sovereign whose obligation to govern impartiality is as compelling as it is an obligation to govern at all, and whose interest, therefore, in a criminal prosecution is not that it shall win a case, but that justice shall be done. As such, he is in a peculiar and very definite sense the servant of the law, the twofold aim of which is that guilt shall not escape or innocence suffer. He may prosecute with earnest and vigor indeed, he should do so, but while he may strike hard blows, he is not at liberty to strike foul ones. It is much of his duty to refrain from improper methods calculated to produce a wrongful conviction, as it is to use every legitimate means to bring about a just one. We've mentioned that many times before here in Crime Talk, where it is the job of a district attorney to seek justice, not just to get a conviction. The defense strikes hard, and they basically say the prosecutors are not being truthful. They're withholding information. They're coming up with stories to fabricate evidence, basically, to fit the narrative that they want for the case to proceed, and which is one of the reasons why they kicked off the lead agent in this particular case, simply for the fact that he told them the case was not ready. I know that's a lot of information to digest, but some hard blows are being thrown in the Morphew case. And I'm telling you, I told you, Morphew hired some very good attorneys, and they are leaving no stone unturned. And it's making the prosecution look not so prepared. Now, I hate to compare this, for example, to the Lori Vallow, Chad DeBell matter, but you see what happens in smaller jurisdictions. When they get that big time case, they just not used to turning that much information over on a regular basis. Just saying, let me know what you think. Do you think the prosecutors are incompetent, or is it actually trying to create things that are difficult for the defense? Understand they have an ethical obligation to turn over everything. Next on the docket, an update on Lauren Pazienza. Well, the parents of the 26-year-old New York event planner who allegedly shoved an elderly vocal coach to her death earlier this month may also face criminal charges after they allegedly helped her hide out at their Long Island home for about 2 weeks. Now, Lauren Pazienza was charged with one count of first-degree manslaughter and two counts of second-degree assault after she allegedly pushed Barbara Gustern, 87, to the ground in New York City on March 10th. Now her parents, Daniel, owner of a prosperous cesspool, I guess it's like a septic tank company on Long Island, and Caroline may face charges if the prosecution can prove they helped Pazienza hide from the police. Now, prosecutors said that on Monday, the New York PD detective visited the parents' Long Island home after receiving a tip that Pazienza was hiding out there, but that her father claimed that she was not at home and did not have consent to search the property, which is his absolute right to do, not to let them search the property, I might add. But if he did lie to him, that could be a problem. I'm not sure how they're going to find that out unless somebody confesses. Anyway, Ms. Pazienza then surrendered to police early on Tuesday, and she is being held at the Rikers Island on a $500,000 cash-only bond and faces up to 25 years in prison. Just saying, ladies and gentlemen, how many times have I said, everyone's like, oh, I hate criminal defense attorneys. That'll never happen to me. Do you think the Pazienzas ever thought that this would happen to them or their daughter? You never know. That's why you always need to have your local, lovable criminal defense attorney ready and nearby. Just saying. Now, it's not unprecedented for parents to face consequences for allegedly trying to hide their fugitive children. As you may recall, the family of Gabby Petito, who was murdered by her then-boyfriend, Brian Laundrie, they are suing civilly his parents, saying that the couple knew about the Petito's death and still tried to help their son escape the country. Now, as you may recall, when he departed, there were no criminal charges yet pending. So I think that's going to be a tough sell. I get the Petitos' harm, they're hurt, but at a certain point, you need to accept things and move on. I don't think that suit is going to go anywhere, just like I don't think the Pazienza's parents are going to be charged either. Next, let's support our sponsor for today's show, Crime Talk Prep. And who is helping spread the word why you should be prepared? Well, if it isn't anyone other than President Biden, because he said the other day that food shortages are going to be real. And following that the sanctions that were placed on Russia by the U.S. government, he noted that Russia and Ukraine produce about 25% of the global wheat supply. While neither of these countries export wheat to the United States directly, their absence from the global market is expected to strain supply and push higher prices. And the president also said Russia and Ukraine have been the breadbasket of Europe in terms of wheat and insisted that he and other leaders had long discussions in the G7 about the need to increase and disseminate food production. Now, as the war continues to ravage Ukraine, Americans, particularly those who live paycheck to paycheck, are beginning to feel the financial squeeze on their food prices. So I can recall several people throughout when I said, hey, we have a sponsor, go to this link, Crime Talk Prep, get your stuff. You never know what's going to happen. In today's world, you need to be prepared. I have text messages where people, or responses where people said, Scott, what are you putting on your tinfoil hat? Are you trying to be a prepper? Nope. Just being responsible, because you just never know what's going to happen in the world today. Exhibit A, COVID. Exhibit B, war in the Ukraine. And people are actually saying, oh, all those nuclear missiles that are pointed at the United States, yeah, we could use them. Put them on high alert. Just saying, you may want to be prepared. Go to Crime Talk Prep. Get $50 off your first order when you order. Now, you don't have to order a huge supply. You can order a little, as much as you want. But I'm telling you, be prepared. All right, quick update. Two Utes of America. Do you remember that line from My Cousin Vinny where they talked about the two Utes of America?
The two Utes.
Two what? What was that word?
What word?
Two what?
What?
Did you say Utes?
Yeah, two Utes.
Well, we've got a couple right here for you. Willard Noble Chaden Miller and Jeremy Everett Goodale allegedly. These two Utes allegedly bludgeoned their high school Spanish teacher to death with a baseball bat and then discussed the details of the alleged murder on social media. This is according to some new documents that have been released. Now, the two 16-year-olds are charged with one count each of murder in the first degree and conspiracy to commit a forcible felony over the November 2021 death of 66-year-old Nohima Graber. Now, documents with details about the alleged brutal murder were previously sealed, but recently the judge overseeing the case made them available. The documents allege that a witness who knew Goodale showed law enforcement the defendant's Snapchat message that showed Goodale and Miller were involved in the planning, execution, and disposal of evidence related to the teacher's death. Now, according to the search warrant, the Snapchat message reflects how the teens followed Miss Graber, elaborate on how exactly she was killed, where her body was dumped, and how the evidence was concealed. In an interview with Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation, agents allege that Miller admitted that he provided the wheelbarrow from his own home. A witness allegedly told police they saw a wheelbarrow being pushed down a city street just before midnight on November 2nd of 2021. Now, the court documents offer a timeline for the victim's last moments and the immediate aftermath. Now, Graber apparently parked her car at the park on the day she died at around 4 p.m. Her car left the park's parking lot roughly 42 minutes later, followed by a pickup truck. Now, the judge denied separate defense requests asking for media and the public to be kept from viewing the upcoming trial information in the evidentiary ruling. Both defendants appealed those two rejections in turn, and the judge paused proceedings as the Iowa Supreme Court decided to accept or deny their appeals. A hearing scheduled for Thursday was delayed that would have settled whether the pair would have been tried in the Hawkeye State's juvenile or adult court system. If they are tried as an adult and convicted, Miller and Goodale would spend time in prison, but not life without parole, because such a sentence is not allowed under the Iowa Constitution. But if the teens were tried and convicted as juveniles, they would be released when they turn 18. Let me know about that. You think 2 years is enough if they are convicted? And oh yeah, by the way, and I know a lot of people think that Snapchat, it disappears, it doesn't go away. Well, it may go away for people on the app itself, but all that stuff gets stored at the big Snapchat computer system. Trust me on this one. Seen it in cases, and apparently, just like the law enforcement did here, they know that as well. So, just a little heads up for you. There's nothing private if you use it on the computer. It can be found. It can be hacked. And finally, our dumb criminal. Let's do a quick recap. It's kind of a light week just because of scheduling issues, but Monday, the anonymous driver in the flying Tesla that hit several trash cans and two parked cars, I think he's the winner. Kendall Russ, the contractor working at the Navy SEAL Museum, allegedly tried to steal a ballistic vest that was worn by a member of the team who raided Osama bin Laden's hideout. He said he was just taking the vest because he wanted to take a picture of it. Well, maybe you should take a picture of it at the museum so you didn't get accused of taking it. And today, just hours after exchanging vows, newlyweds John Gerhard and Stephanie Genis got into some sort of altercation inside their hotel room in Naples, Florida. People found the bride in a wedding dress torn and covered in blood, and the groom with several injuries to his face. Now, Genis face and chest were covered in blood, and she was crying, according to the police notes. Genis told the police that the couple had gotten into a fight about her brother, and it turned violent. Now, Miss Genis suffered a bloody nose, busted lip, and a swollen eye. Gerhard said his new wife headbutted him, cutting the bridge of his nose, and since Genis and Gerhard each claimed to be the dispute's primary aggressor, both were arrested for domestic battery. Genis and Gerhard were each released yesterday on a $1,000 bond. Now, getting arrested on your wedding day for domestic violence, it's not a good start. Not a good start, ladies and gentlemen. And you know how I feel about you never, ever, ever hit a girl, even particularly on her wedding day. But really, that is not a good start for a long and blissful marriage for sure. Somehow I think that one's not going to work out well if they're already fighting about the in-laws. All right. Thanks for watching. Thanks for being flexible this week. Just because of schedule, you know, had to do that lawyer stuff, and that takes priority. So thanks for watching. We'll see you next time on Crime Talk.